I have an enviable task. I was just in the room for Judge Napolitano's lecture. He gave a very rousing defense of freedom. And now I have the job of giving you a very dull lecture on the a priori. I'm tempted. Certainly I'm very surprised to see so many people here. If I were you, I'd certainly go to Joe Salerno's lecture. In fact, I was thinking of going there myself. that would get me into trouble. But you're assuming if I went up to his lecture, that I couldn't give my lecture. But my old friend Father James Sadowski, who taught philosophy at Fordham for a great many years, used to say there's nothing logically impossible about someone being in two places at the same time. And not only thought that it was logically possible, he thought some people had actually done it, but I'm not going to try it. Okay, so what I'm going to be doing in this lecture is we'll be going over some of the material I gave in the opening lecture on the a priori, but I think when you hear it again, it'll be, I hope, a bit easier to follow. What I'm going to be doing differently in this lecture, what will be added, I think this sometimes very much helps when you're in philosophy to understand the philosophical point of view, is to see the view that Mises defended against its critics. And I'll be dealing principally with the logical positivists, who are a group of people who criticized Mises. But if I have time, I'll also deal with some other people who criticized Mises, such as Sir Karl Popper and his followers. But I don't know whether I'll have enough time to get into that. We'll see. Now, Mises makes at first sight, a rather surprising claim. He says that economics makes a fundamental contribution to epistemology. Epistemology is the branch of philosophy that studies the knowledge, asks how, if at all, are we justified when we say that we know something or claim to know something, and would deal with problems of skepticism. Some people think we don't know anything. Others are sure of it. So in the epistemology is the branch of philosophy that looks at claims to knowledge and their justification. So Mises says economics makes a fundamental contribution to this branch of philosophy. And why does it do that? Well, Mises said economics uses a different method of inquiry from the one used in the physical sciences. So he thinks the physical sciences are one way to come up with knowledge, the method used in the physical sciences, one way to come up with knowledge. But there's another way you can arrive at knowledge, and that's the method used in economics. So he thinks that because economics has come up with this different method from the physical sciences, then it's made a contribution to epistemology. Now, we want to now raise a question. This is one related to a question I raised in the first lecture that I gave. If economics has made this contribution to epistemology, isn't this generally recognized by epistemologists? Now, actually, we now find there are people who give courses on philosophy of economics, but when Mises was writing, that wasn't the case. And it's still true in standard courses on epistemology. You probably won't hear very much about economics and how economics is conducted. I should say, when Mises raises this claim that economics is making a contribution to epistemology because it's come up with a new method. He doesn't mean to confine the claim to his own kind of Austrian economics. What he has in mind is economics as generally practiced, at least at his time, what we call microeconomics today. He thinks that there is a body of accepted discipline arrives at its conclusions by a distinct method, and that's what he thinks has made the contribution to epistemology. So he has in mind basically a standard price theorem. And as I went into some detail in the lecture on Monday, Mises thinks that a lot of people just don't like the idea of science of economics, because if you have laws of economics, that they limit what people, especially political actors, can do. Supposing someone wants to enact a minimum wage laws, and then applying economic principles would suggest that this wouldn't achieve the goals of helping workers that the advocates of minimum wage laws say they favor, then you would have a reason not to enact such laws. But people who want the laws of that kind don't like the idea of being limited in that way, so they're not very sympathetic to the notion of economics. And so Mises thinks this is one reason that people don't have neglected the contribution of economics to epistemology. And as we'll see later in the lecture, Mises tends to view pretty much all opposition to economics as he practices it as motivated by the unwillingness of people to accept the conclusion that economics might lead you to. As we'll see later, the group, the logical positivists, was the principal philosophical group opposing him. And Mises thought, well, their real motivation is most of them were socialists and they didn't like where economics was headed. Particularly, they didn't like, remember, Mises had a famous argument in 1920 saying that economic calculation under socialism isn't possible. So if you're a socialist, you're not going to view that conclusion with pure enthusiasm. So again, Mises says this is a reason those people oppose economics. And then they neglected the contribution of economics to epistemology. Now, what is to get to what this method is, I think we should be useful to contrast economics with the method of the physical sciences. Now, in the physical sciences, what we're doing is studying matter in motion. And by matter, I don't mean to exclude. I'm just using this in a very broad sense. Sometimes in physics, they would talk about fields or energy or various other things, but it's always some sort of physical entity or quantum perturbations are in some sense physical. So you're always concerned with some kind of physical phenomenon. What you're trying to do is study the laws of motion of those physical phenomena. So let's take a very simple physical law, that Boyle's law, that PV equals K, where P is it applies to gases, P is the pressure on a gas, V is the volume, and K is a constant. So what this law is basically saying, at least under certain conditions, that the pressure varies inversely with the volume. So if you increase the pressure on a gas, you'll decrease the volume. The pressure and the volume, if you multiply the pressure by the volume, you'll always get the same result. So if you increase one, the other will have to decrease. Now you notice this law, and this applies to all physical laws, makes no reference to purposes or ends. Suppose the pressure on the gas goes up. Well, we wouldn't say the volume of the gas sees that the pressure has gone up, so the volume is going to have to lower itself so that K, the constant value K, is preserved, that the pressure and volume of the gas aren't entities with purpose. It's just what we have here is simply the statement of a physical relationship, but there's no attribution of ends or purposes. Now, here's where Mises thinks the decisive contribution of economics to epistemology comes in, that unlike just matter considered by itself, people have purposes. People act to achieve goals. So if we just take material particles, we couldn't speak of what the goals or ends of the material particles are, but when we're talking about people, we can. People have purposes and ends. Now, I'm sure there's an obvious objection here. Somebody could say, well, but what if you hold that people are just composed of physical particles? Well, then, if you held that view, then you would say when these particles are aggregated in the appropriate way, it turns out that people have, that you get a person, and persons have ends, and goals, purposes. So some new way of explaining what's going on comes in. This view doesn't involve the rejection of a materialist point of view, but it doesn't, of course, require it either. Now, one side point. What I've done so far when I'm giving Mises' view is contrast the physical laws of science with human beings, and say when we're in physical science, all we have is matter in motion. There's no question of purpose involved. But when we have human beings, then we do have purpose. Now, there are some people who don't agree with that view. There are people who don't think that human beings have ends or purposes. But there are also people who think that it makes sense to use the notion of purpose when applied to matter. Some people say, well, even in the physical world outside of human beings, we can talk of purposes in nature. Just as a sideline, the very famous philosopher Thomas Nagel had a book that came out last year called Mind and Cosmos that attracted an enormous number of reviews. Most of the reviews were very critical, but he thought the notion of purpose or teleology in nature makes sense. So this is a view Mises would reject. But so Mises wants to say, Mises is in a sense agreeing with he's not a proponent of teleology or purpose altogether, but some people are. It tends to be in philosophy, some people think the notion of purpose makes no sense unless there's some mind involved, and then others, and you can find this in Aristotle again, Nagel has this thing, you can talk about purposes in nature. So this has been, Mises wants to come down and say there aren't purposes in nature, that there's a contrast between human beings and the rest of the natural world. Now, we see actions. Action is not a very difficult concept. We see actions all the time. For example, suppose I were to now abandon my lecture and go up and hear Joe Salerno. That would be an action. That's what I should do, but weakness of will prevents me from doing it. So here I would have a goal, and then I'd have a means to achieve a goal. This is very, very straightforward. Now, we all know what actions are, but to understand action, we need certain concepts like ends or means. Now, there's in saying that, in order to understand an action, we need to use certain concepts. There's nothing mysterious about this. We're not making any philosophically outrageous claim. An analogy would be, supposing you are listening to a foreign language, say you're listening, just to take an example at random, of people speaking Chinese. I don't know any Chinese, so I wouldn't be able to understand what the people are saying. In order to understand Chinese conversation, I would have to have certain concepts. I have to know the meaning of the various words in Chinese. So we could draw an analogy here. In order to understand what's going on, we see certain kinds of physical behavior, people are acting, I have to have certain concepts. If I don't have those concepts, I won't understand what they're doing. Now, Mises says that these concepts have to be what he calls a priori. This is one of the term that causes a lot of trouble, gets him into a lot of controversy. But he doesn't mean by this anything really that controversial. What he means is, revert to the example of foreign language, he thinks that you have to have these concepts in order to understand what's going on when we're talking about, if you see people acting, you won't be able to understand what's going on unless you have certain concepts such as ends and means. Otherwise, you would just see movement of various kinds. You wouldn't know what's going on. Now, one confusion people fall into here, and this is one reason I think the notion, Mises' notion of a priori concepts, is sometimes taken to be more controversial than it actually is, is that there's a view in philosophy called innate ideas that holds that people are born with certain concepts, or at least if not the actual concept, they have the abilities to acquire these concepts given a certain trigger in the environment. So Descartes famously held that people are born with certain ideas. It isn't the case, according to Descartes, that we acquire all our concepts from the empirical world. We're born with them. We may need the environment to trigger them, but we're really born with them. And this is a very controversial view. There are people like Jerry Fodor who hold that view today. Other people reject it. But when Mises is talking about the a priori, it doesn't involve him in this controversy. It's all he's saying is that in order to understand a particular part of experience, you need to have these concepts. It's not a view about how people acquire the concepts in the first place. It's just if you don't have the concepts, you won't be able to understand that part of experience. Now, Mises thought that we can study action and the a priori concepts involved in it. And in studying that, he calls this study of action by considering the concept. He calls this praxeology. He has a way of, he likes somewhat unusual terms. You'll find all sorts of like polylogism. Although English wasn't his native language, he liked to come up with new words. Well, I suppose praxeology wasn't, he didn't coin the term, but he had a very wide vocabulary. Now, one point to note here, it's just a side point, but some people think wrongly call the deductive conceptual method praxeology, but this isn't the way Mises used the term. He meant praxeology is the science of action, and in praxeology, as he carried it out, there's a deductive method, but the deductive method isn't the praxeology. It's what the praxeology is the science of action. Now, as I said several times, people make this notion of the a priori much harder than it has to be. I'm trying to make it easier. I can't say I don't claim the much more ambitious task of making it interesting. That's something someone with my lecturing style is incapable of, but at least it's not, I don't think it's very, very hard. Now, the one thing I think to avoid is we shouldn't think because we're talking about analyzing the concept of action, what's involved in the concept, we shouldn't think of action that when Mises is talking about a priori means mental. He isn't talking about ideas in his own mind. He's talking about actions out there in the world. He's claiming that there's a deductive knowledge of actions that you learn about by thinking about the concept of action, but it's actions in the world that he has in mind. Now, I mentioned Descartes on Innate Ideas. Now, as I'm sure most of you know, there is a famous problem raised by Descartes, a skeptical problem, where he says, well, he wants to doubt everything that it's possible for him to doubt. And then he says, well, what would be, he could doubt the existence of the external world. He could really doubt everything. What is there anything that you would get if you doubted everything you possibly could? Would you have anything left? Of course, he famously says, yes, he couldn't doubt his own existence because if he's doubting, he couldn't doubt without existing. So he knows that he exists, and then he goes on to try to argue that he can show that the external world exists. Now, that's a fascinating philosophical problem, but that's not what Mises is concerned with. Sometimes I've had over the years I've been giving lectures here, some student will say, oh, well, how does Mises know that he's talking about anything other than what's going on in his own mind? And the answer to that is Mises isn't trying to solve a skeptical problem, the existence of the external world, or how do we know there are other minds. On the problem of other minds, I always remember there was a professor at UCLA named Richard Yost who had very good sarcastic remarks, and his answer to the question, are there other minds? He said, well, I know some of them. But I say, Mises isn't trying to solve his skeptical problem. He's taking it for granted that there are people in the world who act, and he's asking what are the implications of that fact. What he's doing, as I say, he's not trying to ask how do we justify the existence of the external world. Rather, he's raising the question, since we do know that we and other people act, how is that possible? How is it possible that we know this? How do we acquire such knowledge? He's not raising the skeptical question. How do we is it the case that we know there are other people, that we know other people act? He's taking it for granted that we do know this, and he's asking how we do know this. So, as I say, if you ask the question, how do we know the conclusions of praxeology apply to other people, you're really basing yourself on an assumption that Mises rejects. Now, I now want to get into the good stuff, which is the fight between Mises and his critics. Now, the main group who opposed Mises were the logical positivists. And they were a group of philosophers and scientists who, most of them lived in Vienna, and they flourished around the 1920s and 30s. They included the head of the Vienna Circle, sometimes called the Schlick Circle, was Moritz Schlick, who was a professor of philosophy at the University of Vienna. He, in his politics, was rather a classical liberal, but almost all the others in the group were socialist inclined, at least those who held political opinions. Rudolf Carnap, who was actually German but lived in Vienna, was a member of the group. Now, the one that Mises absolutely hated was Otto Neurath, who had been for a while a minister in the Bavarian Soviet Republic, which had been kind of a communist government that had been established for a while after the collapse of the German Empire in World War I. Mises really couldn't stand him at all. There were others who were in the group, like Friedrich Weismann, the great mathematician Kurt Gödel, who was not a positivist, would go to the group. And there were associated groups like there was a Berlin group with Hans Reichenbach, was a leading figure of that. I should mention on the logical positivist, what happened to one member of the group illustrates that being in the academic profession can be dangerous. This concerns Moritz Schlick, who, as I say, was the head of the group. He had had a student, I think his name was Johannes Nelbach, who had done a thesis with him in 1931. Then in 1936, Nelbach thought that logical positivism was having a very bad effect on morality. And according to some accounts, he was also thought that Schlick was interested in a woman that he was interested in. So he wasn't very happy about this, and he went to see Schlick at the University of Vienna, and he did what I hope no one does to me, even if you don't like my lectures. He came up and shot him, he killed him. I remember I had a teacher, was a great medievalist, Gerhard Laudner, who told me he remembered that incident very well. He'd been around at the University of Vienna when that happened. But after this happened, there was a tremendous, I think it became a big political case because the Nazis got involved, and they remember the Nazis didn't take over Austria until March 1938, but they were very active at the time. And Nelbach said, well, you know, he was really acting against the nihilism and irrationalism of the time, and people supported him. He claimed that this was Schlick was really a representative of Jewish thought, and he had been acting in the national interest. Now, there was a problem with that view, which was that Schlick wasn't Jewish, but somehow that was neglected. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and then he when the Nazis took over, he was released. And I think after the war, he worked as a forest ranger. But that does illustrate, I think, you have to be careful. That's why when I lecture, I always wear a bulletproof vest. Now, the main point of the Vienna Circle, I remember Mises thought their main point was they were against economics, but what they claimed to be the main point, and I think really was their main point, was they were opposed to what they call metaphysics. And by metaphysics, they meant that the view that you can find out about the nature of the world just by thinking about it. Hegel's philosophy would be an example of that. Philosophy of Leibniz is an example. For example, say Leibniz thought that just by pure argument, not by empirical research, you could find out that the world really consists of what he called monads, which were really infinitesimally small minds, that what we think of as matter is just doesn't really exist. It's just an appearance of all these minds. And he thought that's a very surprising conclusion, but he thought that could be established just by thinking about things. So the logical positivist said, no, you can't do that. You can only find out about the world through the physical sciences. You have to use the method of physics and chemistry, so on, biology, give you genuine knowledge. If you really want to find out what the world is like, you have to follow the method of sciences. There's no such thing as metaphysics in way of giving you knowledge of the world just by thinking about it. Ludwig Wittgenstein also held that view. He wasn't a logical positivist, although he influenced them, but he also very famously held, he said, philosophy leaves everything as it is. He thought you couldn't just come up with the nature of the world just by thought. Now, I should mention, I didn't put a slide on it, I think it's rather interesting. Mises agreed with the positivists about this. Mises didn't believe in metaphysics in this way I've explained. He accepted what the positivists said about metaphysics, although didn't. He thought where they went wrong was to rule out economics. Now, the positivists said, and Mises, I think, accepted this claim, that in order to gain knowledge of the world, you had to use the methods of the sciences. You can't just come up with, say, imagine we want to know, do bodies attract each other? What is the nature of gravity? We'd have to rely, at least in part, on experiments to figure that out. We couldn't just come up with a kind of a purely conceptual physics. So Mises accepted that, but he said, this is fine as far as economics is concerned because economics is a science. And here's where the positivists differed with him. They said, no, economics as Mises practices it is not a science. And why did they say that? Well, they said economics violates the requirements of a principle that they placed great stress on called the verification principle. Now, the verification principle says that every statement that gives us knowledge about the world has to be one that's confirmable by sense experience. So suppose I say, there are more than five people in this room, a fact that greatly surprises me. We could confirm that by counting the number of people. If I say I hadn't come into the room, someone says, let's imagine someone outside the room didn't look into it, the person wouldn't be able to know how many people are in the room if he had no other source of sensory knowledge about it. You couldn't just figure it out just by thinking about it. Now, there's a stronger version of the verification principle. That the weaker version is just, in order for a statement about the claim new knowledge world to be meaningful, it has to be confirmable by sense experience. The stronger version is that the meaning of the statement just is the way you verify it. So the first version is just saying, if the statement has meaning, then you have to be able to confirm it by some sensory means. The stronger version is the meaning just is the way you verify it. Now, this doesn't seem, the stronger version seems pretty evidently wrong. Supposing you say Caesar crossed the Rubicon River in 49 BC. Well, how would you verify that? You maybe look up various books on Roman history that say that, or you might look up documents where that's claimed, where from which you can figure out that he was crossed the Rubicon in that year. But the meaning of the statement wouldn't be that if you looked up those books or documents, that's what you'd find. Clearly, the meaning of the statement is different from how you verify. And I think, as Bertrand Russell pointed out, you can't really get an idea of how you would verify something unless you first know what it means. I'll just pass it. Everybody knows that when Caesar died in 44 BC, when he was assassinated, his last words were, "Et tu, Brute." But can anybody tell me, what did Brutus say to Caesar just before he said that? It's, "How many eggs did you have for breakfast this morning, Caesar?" I was expecting more laughter for that. I'm sorry. Well, sometimes I tell jokes that I think are extremely funny, but no one else laughs. Like one I thought was made me laugh for quite a few minutes is one where there's a man whose wife was in the hospital to have a baby, and when the doctor came out, he said, the father says, "Was it a boy or a girl?" And the doctor says, "Yes." Okay. But we can see just a further problem in the verification principle. I didn't put this on the slide, but it makes sense. I think it's plausible, say, to take this example I gave, that if you wanted to know how many people are in this room, you'd have to look or count them. You couldn't just figure it out just by thinking about it. But it wouldn't follow from that. Suppose somebody had no way of confirming a statement, that the statement wouldn't have any meaning. Say, suppose I said there's some part of the universe that's in principle impossible to have access to, and it has such and such properties, then that wouldn't be confirmable by sensory observation, but it would seem like it would still have some meaning. Now, you might say, okay, well, there you have the verification principle. Suppose you accept it. You could say, does this really pose a problem for Mises? Because couldn't he say, it meets the economics meets the verification principle. Suppose you say people always choose their highest value preference. So don't you confirm that every time you make a choice? So somebody could say, look, I can accept the verification principle. Praxeology passes it. But the logical positivists, didn't accept this sort of response. What they said was, if Mises is claiming that the laws of economics can be known a priori, I say you can know them just by thinking about them. An a priori truth is one that you're justified in holding just by thinking about it. You don't need to test it out in experience. So remember, the principle that the logical positivist said is, in order to have truth about the, that apply, gives you knowledge of the new knowledge of the empirical world, it has to be testable by sense experience. But here we're claiming we can know it just by thinking about it. Now, as I say, it isn't clear that that's, you can still confirm something by sensory experience if you can know it by thinking about it. It isn't clear why those two claims would be opposed. But the positivists thought they were, because what they said is, if you're, and this is the key point, if you claim to know something just by thinking about it, then the only way you can do that is if you're, your claim is just a tautology. It's something that is true just because of the meanings of the term, so it's not really telling you anything new. What they said was, suppose you say, people always choose their highest value preference. They said, well, that's true just because Mises has defined the highest value preference is the one that you actually choose. So then, of course, it's going to come out true that you always choose your highest value preference, but that isn't really telling you anything. Now, we could ask the question, won't go into it in any detail, is that true? Is that the way Mises defines the your highest value preference? It doesn't appear that it is. It's just, he thinks it's true you pick your highest value preference, but he doesn't define it as the one you actually chose. But they thought that that was the way he defined it, or at least that he'd have to do it that way if his claim was true and a priori, as he thought it was. So to go into tautology in a bit more detail, a tautology is either a definition, part of a definition, or a law of logic. And the claim that the positivists make with tautologies don't give you any new knowledge about the world. For example, an example that Wittgenstein gives is, suppose, say you're, somebody asks you about the weather here. Say somebody said, what's the weather here? And you say, either it's raining or it's not raining. Or what you said is true, but it doesn't tell the person who asked you that what the weather is. You just said, you just plugged in raining to a logical law. You haven't given any new information. And if you're talking about a definition or a part of definition, you're not conveying, you can't acquire knowledge just from coming up with a definition. You can't make something true just by defining terms in a certain way. So that was what their objection is. If Mises says we have a priori knowledge, well, a priori knowledge has to consist of tautologies, but then it isn't telling you anything about the world. Now, Mises had reply to this was, he said, well, he didn't reject, now this is a point also that is very often missed, that people, Mises did not reject the logical positivist claim that a priori knowledge consists of tautologies. I think there's a plausible case to be made that he should have rejected it, but he didn't. He said, okay, they are tautologies, but very often, sometimes at any rate, tautologies do help you understand the world. Say, if you take the laws of economics just to be arbitrary definitions, well, then how do you account for the fact that economics is successful at explaining the world and what he thought? Again, here he appealed to his notion of a priori concepts. He said, we know that economic theory applies to the real world because we couldn't make sense of certain aspects of experience without using these concepts. So even if a concept consists of the propositions or tautologies, we still know that they apply to the world because they're a presupposition of experience. And they sometimes, again, he held that a tautology can be surprising to people, just as in mathematics. Some people say the positivist thought mathematics consists of tautologies, but mathematicians come up with theorems that are certainly not obvious to people all the time. And he said, well, economics is like this. We know it applies to the real world because we could not make sense of experience without using these a priori concepts. Once we have the a priori concepts, we can reason about them. And then even if they're tautologies, they come up with, we can come up with surprising and important results using them. Now, one, just a couple more points to make on this. Although Mises is talking about a priori concepts, and this is really just a point I made before, but just kind of making it more explicit, he's talking only about a priori concepts at what we call local level, meaning in order to understand this particular aspect or part of experience, namely experience involving action, we have to use the concepts of praxeology. If we didn't know what ends and means were, we would just see people moving in various ways. We wouldn't know what was going on. Just to say, if we don't have the concept of money, we won't understand what's going on. Say, we'll see people passing pieces of paper to each other, but we won't know why they're doing it. This doesn't commit Mises or Misesian to some view that all our knowledge is a priori. Mises may well have been sympathetic to that view, but he's not committed to that view just by talking about a priori concepts in economics. And on the verification principle, it turned out there were a lot of problems with the verification principle. One was that, this is one that was raised very early on, I think, the Polish philosopher Roman Ingarden raised it, the British writer Isaiah Berlin also raised it, that the principle appears to be self-refuting. The principle says, I've given so far the part of the verification principle, for something to be empirically meaningful, it has to be confirmable by sense experience. Now, the other part, there are also meaningful statements that are what they call analytic, which are just tautology. So what that principle says, you have a certain statement, they say, is this an analytic statement? If it isn't, is it something that's confirmable by sense experience? And if it doesn't pass either of those tests, then it's meaningless. So the problem, or a problem appeared to be, is that the principle itself doesn't appear to pass the test, because is it something that empirically confirmable? Doesn't appear that. Or is it analytic? Is it just part of the notion of meaning? Doesn't appear that something is meaningful only if it passes that test. It doesn't appear to be. It appears to be more of a proposal that certain people who don't like metaphysics have put in to get rid of statements or claims they don't like, but it appears that it violates its own prescription. Now, another problem was, remember, what the positivists were trying to do was they wanted to say that to get knowledge of the world, you have to use the methods of the sciences, and they don't want metaphysical claims that you could know about the world just by thinking about them. But it proved in practice people couldn't come up with a version of this principle that would get rid of the statements they wanted to get rid of and keep in the ones they thought were meaningful. You could give statements of the principle that would involve rejecting most of science, or you could try to avoid that. And if you loosened up the principle, it would turn out every statement passes it. So nobody was ever able to come up with a satisfactory version of it. But I think the most fundamental criticism we could raise of this principle is, why should we accept it? It's just a statement that the positivists don't like metaphysics, so they want to come up with a principle that gets rid of it. But why should, suppose somebody likes metaphysics or thinks that you can know truth about the world just by thinking about it. Why should that person accept the principle? What's supposed to be the argument for the verification principle where they don't really give one? I think if you look at a book, it's a very good book by Carl Hempel called Aspects of Scientific Explanation. Hempel was a member of the Vienna Circle. He was one of the younger members. He's one of the top philosophers of science of the 20th century. You'll see he has a long chapter on the verification principle and attempts to formulate. But you'll see if you look at what he says, he never gives any real argument that we should accept the principle. He seems to take for granted that some version of the principle is true. And then he's saying, well, how can we formulate it? And he gives up. But it's not evident why we should embark on that quest in the first place. Now, I want also to mention another type of attack on could be used against Mises possibly, although the person who came up with this view certainly didn't use it against Mises. I don't think he was, as far as I know, he never wrote about Mises. And I have in mind the great American philosopher W.V.O. Quine. Now, what I mentioned so far when talking about the logical positivists, I mentioned in the verification principle they have their analytic statements, that's to say, ones that are definitions or parts of definitions or logical laws, and their empirical statements, sometimes these are called synthetic statements, ones that are verifiable by sense experience. So, again, remember the verification, people who favor the verification principle will say that a meaningful statement has to be one of those two. If it isn't either analytic or synthetic, then it doesn't pass the test. Now, Quine said you can't really distinguish analytic from synthetic statements, that really all statements, he thought that statements aren't evaluated individually. So he says the science or knowledge faces the world as a whole. So we have a whole series of interconnected claims that are tested. And we can't really say some of these claims are just true by definition, others are empirically testable. If something were true by just from the definition, then nothing could ever show it to be false. There would be no evidence that could show it to be false. But Quine said, well, there really isn't anything like that. Anything is in principle revisable, even though, in fact, there are some things we're very unlikely to want to change. But Quine said, well, look, there isn't anything that we can just kind of insulate and say, that's it. One of Quine's teachers was the British philosopher who was teaching at Harvard, Alfred North Whitehead. And Whitehead held a similar view about laws of nature and mathematical truth. He said, well, in principle, they're revisable. So one of his students said, well, Professor Whitehead, do you think that it could ever be the case that 2 plus 2 will it always, do you think it'll sometimes be the case that 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4? And he said, not for a long time. But what we could say, I think, in answer to Quine is, it isn't clear, I mean, it isn't clear that he's right about that. I mean, even he had trouble with the laws of logic. I think he is right that many statements about the empirical world aren't just testable one by one, that they're part of a web of interconnected claims. But I don't think he came up with anything that shows that we can't have knowledge claims that are true just by thinking about them. As I say, though, in one way we could say Quine has actually helped the Austrian project, because remember, the big criticism the positive had in with Mises, they say, well, look, you're claiming that you can know certain things just by thinking about them, but if you can know something by thinking about it, it's an analytic statement, and that isn't telling you anything. Well, Quine says you can't really distinguish analytic from synthetic statement. So if he's right, and you combine, say he's right about that, and he has some interesting arguments for that, and you combine that with the view that he didn't hold, that you can know things about the world just by thinking about them, then you don't have any real problem, or at least not the problem the positivists came up with the notion of a priori knowledge. Well, I have a very short time left. I didn't make a slide of this, but I'll say a little bit about another critic of the praxeology. Again, this writer, Karl Popper, didn't intend for it to apply his view of science to be a criticism of economics. In fact, he was personally, he had a very high view of Mises. He mentions in some of his correspondence, he met Mises. He obviously respected him, although his own views were more of a social democratic kind than the laissez-faire views that Mises held. But he said, well, Mises looked at him as a very suspicious figure. Now, what he said first in his famous book, Logic of Scientific Discovery, which was published, I think, in 1934 in Vienna, was he didn't have, as the positivist did, a criterion of meaning. Remember, the positivist said that the scientific statement has to be meaningful, it has to be verifiable by the senses in order to be meaningful. Now, Popper said, I'm not going to come up with a criterion of meaning, but he did say, he wants rather a criterion for separating science from non-scientific statements. And his criterion was a scientific statement has to be falsifiable. There has to be something that can show it to be false. Say, if I say there's no more than 25 people in this room, that could be falsified by somebody counting and saying, well, in fact, there is 37 people in the room, so you're wrong. And Popper, these people who apply Popper views to economics say, Mises' praxeology doesn't pass this test because you can't falsify a praxeological claim. It's supposed to always hold true. There's nothing that could you could come up with that would show that the claim was false. And Mises' reply to that is, he said, well, you know, he says it's an ultimate foundation of economic science. He said, well, you know, all right, Popper can make this claim if he wants. He says, Popper can say, this is what I take science to be. But why should we accept such a claim? Why don't we say instead what the philosopher should do is look at what actual knowledge that people have, and if philosophers do that, they'll see economics really is a branch of knowledge and it's come up with claims. Well, there's a great deal more one could say about Popper, but I think we'll, fortunately for you, I'll stop now. Okay, thanks very much.